I'm Jeannie Olson, and I've been a chaplain for 27 years. I'm in Davenport, Iowa. I work for a medical center called Genesis Medical Center. We have four campuses, and we have chaplains on three campuses. We have eight chaplains in my department, which is pretty amazing, because many times they're reducing in hospitals, and we keep growing, which I'm very grateful for. We do on-call duty, so we have evening on-call, we have weekend on-call, so we may get called in for a death, for a code blue, for a code pink, which is a child, for people, for children that are born and they need to baptize the child quickly and there isn't a pastor. We get called in if someone is going to be taken off of a vent and the family wants a presence of a chaplain. So we do all sorts of things. I have been with the oncology floor since I started 27 years ago, and now I also cover, I've covered a lot of different floors, but right now I'm covering also the neurology floor. So I have a variety of situations. We also are a clinical pastoral education setting center, and so I mentor chaplain interns at least two a year. The other thing that I do that I spend a lot of time doing is we have a volunteer program with the spiritual care department. We have 42 volunteers who are trained by me for 20 weeks, 2 hours a day. So they are trained and then commissioned, and then they come once a week. At 9 o'clock in the morning they come and they make volunteer visits until 12, where they are debriefed by one of the chaplains. I love that part of my job because people come in and it's just fun to watch them blossom as visitors who can go up on the floor and make visits. So that's kind of the background information of what I do and who I am. Ours, we combine with a Catholic hospital, and they have Catholic volunteers who come around every day and bring the Catholics. The Protestants, we figure if they're Protestant, they probably have a church, and their church will bring it to them. But if they say, gee, I don't have a church, but this is important to me, and I'm dying, or whatever, we will have one of our ordained pastors. I'm not ordained, so I don't bring communion to folks, but I will ask one of my colleagues to do that. So, yes, it's my request, but all Catholics are. And we call all the churches, too, to let them know that their parishioners are with us. So. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to explain much of what's in this book, Final Gifts. Now, considering that I didn't have the bookstore order these, there aren't any of these in the bookstore, and I'm at fault. But you can go online and get this book. It's Final Gifts, Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly. It is the most important thing that happened to me in 27 years to make me a chaplain, next to my clinical pastoral education training. It is the most important book, probably because I work with a lot of dying patients, and it's given me gifts that I will always treasure, and I know I will always use. There's chairs up here. I made this little path, so if you're late, you have to come up here, I'm afraid. I believe, however, that all people should know how to be present with their loved ones when they're dying. You shouldn't have to call a chaplain that doesn't know your loved one or isn't present to you, but you should be able to sit with or have someone sit with you when you're dying that knows you and loves you. And so that's why I'm thrilled to always kind of teach this class, because I want to give you the tools you need to be able to do that and do it comfortably. I think we need to be able to understand the communication of the dying, and it's sometimes very, very symbolic and metaphorical. We want to be able to meet the dying person's needs so we can alleviate their fears and we'll know what to say. We can actually talk them through the transition as they're dying. I'm going to give you tools for that. And if we have this knowledge and understanding and skills, we're going to be more comfortable with what could be uncomfortable, and we'll be able to be a blessing to that person, and they then will in turn bless us. So that's what my goal is for today. What we're going to be talking about is dying that is a progressive dying. It's not the heart attack, and it's not the automobile accident. It's these people that have cancer or have AIDS or have chronic lung problems or have chronic heart problems that can see the path that they're on, that they're moving toward dying. The term that Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly used is nearing death awareness, and they coined this term. They're hospice nurses, and so they do this all the time. And what I love about them is they're hospice nurses, but they truly understand that the spiritual and the physical and the emotional and the social all tie up together when a person is dying. So that's what we are going to do. We never want to discount the communication that someone who is dying gives us. But we also don't want to force. I mean, I think I know what a good death is, but it's never my job to force that on somebody else. Before I was a chaplain, long ago, I went to visit a friend who was dying. Now, she had gotten breast cancer, and she was a very spiritual Christian woman and thought, you know what, I'm just going to take this to my prayer group, and by the power of prayer, I am going to be healed, and won't that be a testimony to God? So she did that, and the cancer got worse. So then she said, I'll go to Chicago to a hospital there that uses nutrition and vitamins and all sorts of wonderful things and prayer, and I'll get better, and the glory will be to God. What happened is the cancer got worse, and now it was too bad to even do the surgery. So now she is dying. She's in hospice but won't admit that because she still believes that God is going to heal her. When my friend took me to go visit her, and she was a best friend and I was just a friend, but she said, don't say anything about dying because she still thinks she's going to live and God's glory. Now, I believe in prayer. I believe in vitamins. I believe in nutrition, but I think God works also through surgery and chemos, etc. There's some chairs up here. So when I went to visit her, there were her four children standing around the bed, and she is struggling in bed like she was Jacob struggling with the angel of death. It was awful. And there her children stood saying, Mom, it's just a bump in the road. You know, Jesus will be here for you. He's, etc. Affirming what she made them believe is that God in the end was going to save her. She ended up dying. And I've never seen four children go through grief. Mary, he's up here. Go through grief in such a terrible, unhealthy way. But we can't force what we think is going to be a good death on someone. They get to make that decision. They're in control. A person who's dying is going to choose someone who they trust and who isn't prattling about other stuff that's unimportant. They're going to choose someone who will listen, who will be present, who will understand, who won't judge. And we talked, my first class was about listening, so if you want to know more about that, listen to that one. I'm trying not to cover the things that I did before. But you come in and visit as a family member or as a friend, and what would be a good way to open up the subject? Ask a few good questions. For example, how are you doing with all this? You want to ask as big a question as possible so that they know that they can go anywhere with it. That's a big question. And they may say, gee, you know, I'm dying, but nobody in my family will let me talk about it because they say I have to keep fighting, yada, yada, yada. Can you talk about what's happening to you? They can go anywhere they want to with that, but they know you're open to sit and listen. Or I really feel sad when I think about what's happening to you because I don't know how this is unfolding and I feel so helpless. What can I do? Okay, but the closer one gets to dying, and that's what we're going to get to today, the messages are harder to read. So I'm going to talk to you about kind of six phenomena that happen that I want you to be keenly aware of. The first phenomenon that we're going to talk about in this nearing death awareness is when people are dying, that they are seeing, talking to, waving, people we can't see. And if you're kind of going, woo, she's really kind of out there, just stick with me, and I hope that you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Could you repeat that sentence again?
That people who are dying see people, talk to people, respond to people that we can't see. In other words, from a different realm. Okay? Many times, and in years gone by, this has been discounted. Oh, you know, she's on those little red pills, and who knows what she's seeing with all those little red pills. Or she's taking a lot of morphine. Or, you know, she's always been a little crazy, and now she's talking to that white wall. Well, I'm going to give you enough examples that I hope that you will realize that I believe this is a true phenomenon. People sometimes hours before they die, sometimes days before they die, are talking to people we can't see. For example, I think of all the evangelists, Billy Graham is probably the only one who hasn't been dragged through the sludge and all things terrible happening to him. But he wrote a book called Angels, God's Secret Agents. And in his book, which was the first book really written about angels, he tells about his maternal grandmother dying. She was in the farmhouse bed that she had lived in her whole life. She'd been in a coma for days. And all of a sudden, she sits up, and she almost laughingly said, "I see Jesus, and he has his arms outstretched to me." Then she smiled, and she paused, and she turned and said, "And there's Ben." Ben was her husband that had died previous to her. And then she looked around and said, "And here are all the angels." And Billy Graham says, "And she slumped over, absent from the body, but present to the Lord." Beautiful story, beautiful story. My similar story was, I was working on the urology floor, and I had a conversation in the morning with this delightful lady by the name of Ruthie. Ruthie was in her 80s. She was as coherent as each one of you. If I had a conversation with you, it would be just like having it with Ruthie. And I was sitting there, and as she was talking to me and telling me the story, she belonged to the gospel temple in Moline. And she never married, but she had two nieces that she loved, and she loved Jesus, and she told me all about her spiritual journey. And while she's talking to me, she all of a sudden she'll look past me and smile. Well, I let that, you know, somebody here. And so this happened three times. And finally I said to her, "Ruthie, you keep looking past me and smiling, and all I see is a white wall." I said, "What are you smiling at?" She looked and she said, "Jesus." I said, "He's here." I was a little nervous. She was just fine. And I said, "He's here?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "What's he doing?" I don't know why I was whispering. I said, "What's he doing?" She said, "He has his arms outstretched to me." I had already read this other book, and I'm going, "Oh my gosh." I said, "Well, how does that make you feel?" She said, "Oh, quite comfortable." Good. Well, we continued this conversation, and a couple more times she looked beyond me and smiled, and I'm nervous, and she's just quite content. Well, I said, we had a prayer together. I left her. Later on that afternoon, as I was about ready to leave, there's nurses running in and out of her room. And I said, "What's the matter with Ruthie?" "We think we're losing her. We're calling her nieces. We're calling her pastor." I said, "Okay, I'm on call. If you need me, call me." But I know she'd want her own minister. So I take off. And I get paged a little while later. They couldn't get a hold of the minister. "She's dying, get here." So I got there as quickly as I could, and Ruthie had died. And her nieces are sitting there sobbing. And the first thing they say is, "We didn't get here in time. We didn't get here in time. We didn't get here in time. And we're her family." And I said, "I have a story for you that happened just this morning." And when I told them how Jesus had been here, they felt, it's okay. The Jesus that she loved had been there, and they weren't. It didn't make any difference because this woman of faith had the Jesus she loved there. In the book, Final Gifts, I'll take some of my stories from that. There was a woman by the name of Emma who kept saying, "If only I could relax, if only I could relax." Now, before I became a chaplain, I was a Martha. When I leave the hospital grounds, I still become a Martha. But when I'm a chaplain, I've learned to sit back and listen. But if somebody had said to me, "If only I could relax," I'd probably say, "Do you need some pillows? Or, you know, do you need an Ativan?" I mean, I would have tried to fix it. This hospice nurse, way wiser than me, said, "What would happen if you relaxed?" Great question. I wouldn't have asked it. "Well, that light would get closer, and I'd get to know all these people." "What people?" said the hospice nurse. Emma looked surprised, as if I was asking a ridiculous question. "Well, all these people around my bed, of course," waving her arm to show the size of the crowd. The RN assured her, "You will relax, Emma. This is a safe place. You will get to know all these people, and the light will get closer." Emma relaxed. She had been heard, and she had been affirmed. I'm going to tell you, I talked with somebody at lunch today that I said, I have so much material and I'm cutting out stuff, but I also want to leave room. And she suggested I go ahead and tell you all my stories and get them in as quickly as I could. And then if you want to talk to me and tell your story to me, and I will hopefully have time for questions, I will be happy to do that. I'm here through Tuesday, so I think I'm just going to go ahead and tell you some of these stories. Julie was one of our favorite patients. She was 40 years old. She had two children. She had a wonderful husband. She was dying of cancer. And she said to all of us on the staff, when I get better, I'm going to come back and I'm going to help other young women who have cancer, who are going through this. Unfortunately, Julie died. About 3 weeks after Julie died, Linda came in. Linda was in her 40s. She had two small children. She was one of the most angry patients I have ever seen. She was so angry with her illness. She was pushing away her children. She was pushing away her parents. She was pushing away her friends. She would only let her husband come and visit her. She was angry. We had her in a room right across from the nurse's station. But around the corner, in a beautiful, bigger room with two walls of windows, and you could see the trees outside, we have a beautiful room that we often use when someone is dying because they're close to the nurse's station, but they have privacy, and it's lovely. So in the middle of the night, the nurses decided we should give Linda a bigger room. So in the middle of the night, they moved her to this other beautiful room. About an hour later, she's on her button saying, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out of here. I don't want to be in this room. There's too many dead people in this room. She didn't know we used that room for that. Nobody knew that. So they said, don't worry, Linda, we'll bring you back. So they brought her back to her old room right across from the nurse's station, tried to calm her down, put a sign on the door that says, do not disturb. The next morning, her husband came, and they told him how upset she had been during the night and that they had moved her and they had moved her back. She said, she's been sleeping, but go ahead now. He got there fairly early. He walked in, and Linda was sitting up in bed, smiling, and said, good morning. And he said, well, good morning. I hear you've had a bad night. He goes, she said, yes, but it's over now, and I'm fine. Really? Okay, great. But because Julie came to visit me, he said, who's Julie? She said, Julie. And he said, do you have a nurse named Julie? Do you have a new doctor named Julie? Do you have a friend named Julie? The nurse said no one was here. Well, Julie came, and now I want you to bring the children this afternoon. Okay. And I think I need to talk to my parents. And so bring them in. He came out and said, this is a different woman that I saw yesterday. This is what she said to me. And she said, Julie came to visit. And the nurse's face sort of dropped at this point. And they said, I think we'll call a chaplain. So I get a phone call, and they brief me on what has happened. And I took Linda's husband aside, and I said, I'm sure this is going to be somewhat unusual, and I'm going to explain something quite unique. But this is what I think happened. And so I told him about Julie and what she had said 3 weeks ago. And then I went and got this book, and I copied, illegally of course, the pages in the book that talked about people seeing people that the rest of us can't see. And he went back in the room and the next couple of days brought in the children, brought in the parents, now brought in friends. And this woman was by the time she died, a week later, had communicated lovingly with everyone in her family. Can we prove that? Absolutely not. But we put the pieces together, and that is what we have come up with. Tisha was my favorite patient. She was 9 years old. I never saw her mother till the night that she died. Her father worked during the day. Parents were separated. I got to know Tisha because one day I said, what can I do for you, Tisha? She said, you can read me Archie comic books. Well, I have no real job description except serve my patients. So I read Archie comic books, and we cemented our friendship. Well, one day I was getting dressed, and I usually wear a sport coat with pockets, and I picked up, this was years ago, one of those cards with a guardian angel pin on it. I had had it for 6 months, never used it, never wore it, but it had been sitting there collecting dust, and I picked it up and I looked at it and I put it in my pocket. I got to work and I got a phone call immediately. Tisha is having nightmares. You need to come up. She's having a terrible time. So there's a seat up here. So I went, knocked on her door, and she said, I said, Tisha, may I come in? She said, yes. And the first thing I want you to know is I am not having nightmares. I was not even asleep when all these things happened. I said, well, she said, you may be seated. I love this. I'm invited in. So I said, well, tell me about it. She said, well, I was awake. And there were two, and she didn't know what to call them. And she didn't say beings. Then she said men, and she didn't know what to call them. But she said two of them at the end of my bed, and they were talking to each other. And I said, well, can you describe them? Did they talk to you? No, they didn't talk to me. But they were talking to each other. And I said, well, tell me what they looked like. Well, one had on a dark hat and a dark coat and dark pants and dark shoes. I said, didn't say anything. Did you like that person? No. I said, well, you said there were two. He said, yes. She said, yes. The other one was clothed in white, kind of like my hospital gown. And she looked at her hospital gown and she said, no. He, and this time she called it, he was as white as lightning. Well, I'd been teaching angel, talks about angels for about 10 years at that point, and then I knew. I said, well, how did that one make you feel? And she said, he looked at me with eyes of love. He looked at me with eyes of love. And I said, now this was before I had read this book and before I knew as much about dying as I perhaps know now. And I knew Tisha was dying, but I didn't know if Tisha knew Tisha was dying. And I said, Tisha, you're a person of faith, right? I knew she was. She said, I belong to the Church of the Nazarene, and I know Jesus. And I said, I knew that. And I said, you know, sometimes God, I start over. What I believe is that we all have guardian angels. We all have them. But most of the time we don't get to see them. But sometimes God lets us see these guardian angels because he wants to reassure us how beloved we are, how loved we are, how present he is with us. I said, so I think that being in white was your guardian angel. And I said, and I happen to have in my pocket the only pin I've ever owned that has an angel in it. And I'd like to give this to you, if you'd like it, to remind you how beloved you are. Oh, pin it right here, she said. And then about a week later, I got called in the middle of the night. Chaplain Olson, we know you're not on call, but Tisha is dying, and they want you there. So I went in, and I'm going to make this part short. What I knew she needed was to have both of her parents there united, sitting on her bed, talking to her, holding her hand. So I said a prayer and some stuff, but she was not very coherent. Her eyes were not focusing. I got her parents there. I said, get on her bed, hold her hands, speak to her. She knows your voices. She needs to hear this. I went over to the window and continued to pray. Her father came over to me and said, she's gone. And she said, did you see her eyes when she died? And I said, no. And he said, all of a sudden they focused, and she looked over at our heads, and she turned to the corner, and she got this beautiful smile on her face. And he said, I believe that she saw the angel that you told her would be there, whether she was in this world or the next. But that was part of things I said, is sometimes they help us when we need to move from this world to the next. And she had told her dad that story. If I get a chance, I'll tell you another story of people who saw those same beings. Two other children in our PEDS unit who also had parents who were not, for whatever reason, able to be present to their children when they were dying, said, and I quote, there was an angel at my window last night. Why, they both had the same line. They both eventually died, and they both had parents who were not able to be present on their journey, which, of course, none of us can even imagine. So, beings that are there for us and give us support. The second phenomena that I believe sometimes happen when people are dying is they talk about travel, they talk about change, they talk about getting things in order. Lisa went down to Texas because her father-in-law was dying. She'd been up in his room, and it was about 12 o'clock, and if you want to open that, getting hot in here? Some of you are saying yes? If it's hot, we can open that door. He said, sure, I have an appointment at 1:10 today. And she said, okay, well, we'll make sure that you're all ready for that. She went down to have lunch, as did everyone else. And they came up about 1 o'clock. He had gone into a coma, and at 1:10, you know what he did? He died. Well, they thought, well, that she had gone and said, you know, is the minister coming? Is the hospice nurse coming? Is he getting new meds or something at 1:10? Said, no. He doesn't have any appointments at 1:10. He did have an appointment at 1:10, and he knew when he was going to die. A patient that I had that had something similar, I had talked to the patient's daughter, and she said, you know, sometimes my mom is totally and completely coherent. And then sometimes she says, I have to get the dishes done. I say, Mom, we have enough money to pay here at the hospital. You don't have to go down in the kitchen and wash dishes. We got enough cash for this. But she won't get off this. And then she'll be coherent, and then she'll do this dish thing again. Well, good news is I had read this book. And I said, is your mom one of these people that when she leaves the house in the morning, the dishes are done, and the paper is folded, and the bed is made, and her shoes are in the closet? And she goes, oh my gosh, that's exactly my mom. And I said, I think this might be a metaphor for the fact that there's something she needs to get in order before she dies. So the next time she's coherent, ask her, Mom, do you need me to bring in, you know, the taxes or your will or the checkbook to pay checks or whatever? 2 days later, she came running down the hall to me and she said, Mom was coherent. I asked her that question. I brought in all the stuff. She's never brought up the dishes again. She was getting ready, but she was using a metaphor. And, you know, how often are we going to be confused unless we're cognizant of the fact that this might be metaphorical language? The third thing that people do is they see places we can't see. I remember our neighbor who was dying would look at the wall in front of him, and he'd wave and he'd smile. And I said to his wife, what do you think? And she said, I think that he's seeing beyond, and he has such a joy and peace on his face. Sometimes you can say to somebody, what are you seeing? They'll say, it's so beautiful. Can you tell us more? Can you give us a... It's too beautiful for words. So they see things that we cannot see. Bobby, is a story from Final Gifts, was dying. His brother and sister had been taking care of him, and he was frightened to die, so the hospice nurse said, I think this is what's going to happen. We're going to take care of you, and you're going to probably go into a coma, and we'll keep you comfortable, etc. And then you will slip over to the other side. And brother and sister were taking care of him, and he'd been in a coma for 3 days. I wonder how many times I've heard they were in a coma for 3 days. Is that not biblical or what? So he'd been in a coma for 3 days, and all of a sudden he sat up, just like Billy Graham's maternal grandmother, and he said, and I quote, I can see the light down the road, and it's beautiful. Out of a coma, eyes open, talks to brother and sister. Well, these folks were Catholic, and so they asked the priest to come and be present to them, say the prayers, and so on. So they told the priest what their brother had done. Bobby was his name. And he says this beautiful, beautiful sentence. Our Christian faith is based on the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus. You witnessed your brother's suffering and death, and he gave you a glimpse of his resurrection. Oh my gosh, how gorgeous is that? How gorgeous is that? Number four is people sometimes know when they're going to die. Michael was a muscular dystrophy patient. Again, a story from the book. And I guess with that, and when I see people coming into our hospital, they get pneumonia a lot. Well, he was in college, and he had all these wonderful college roommates that helped him have the most normal of all possible lives, considering that he had this illness. But he'd get pneumonia, and he'd go back out again. He had this wonderful family that made him also have a very normal life. But he was in the hospital, and that day, in the morning, he called up his family, he called up his friends, he called up his roommates and said, I just want to thank you. I just want to thank you for the life you've given me and all the things you've done that have blessed me, and you have gone out of your way to do this. He made, I don't know how many calls. If he didn't talk to the people who left a message. That afternoon, they got off work, they got out of classes, they came to the hospital like they always did, He was in a coma and died later that day. But he knew it was coming, so he got to participate in that journey that he was making. He got to do what he needed to do to thank the people that he wanted to thank. What a neat thing that is. When you know what's happening, you can participate more significantly. Some people need to have something done in order to die peacefully. And sometimes that's the question we have to ask them. What do you need to die peacefully? Debbie was a patient I will never forget. She was 23 years old. And the first thing she said to me when I went to visit her is, "Jeannie, I'm a single mom. I have a 4-year-old, and my goal is to live long enough so that my 4-year-old remembers me." Okay, we'll do, I will do whatever it takes. You know, we will work together on this. She had a mom and dad that supported her. So she would come into the hospital, out of the hospital, in the hospital, out of the hospital. Finally, she came back, and she was skin and bones, skin and bones. And every Friday that I would leave the hospital, I was sure that she was not going to be there Monday. And I would come back Monday, and she was still there. Finally, I was going to Arizona, and I knew that I'd be gone for a week and that she would be gone. So I went in to say goodbye to her once more. When I came, while I was in Arizona, I read this book. Oh, wow. Changed my life, okay? Read this book. So when I came back and she was still there, I saw her mother in the hallway and I said, "I can't believe Debbie is still here." And her mother said, "Neither can I, and I can't stand," and she burst into tears, "and I can't stand to watch her suffering anymore. You won't believe how bad she looks now." I said, "Well, is there something that's holding her back that we don't know?" Because now I've read the book. And she said, "I don't know. You ask her. I'm going for a cigarette." I said, okay, Jeannie, you can do this. So I walk in her room, and she's sitting in a chair, this woman who couldn't have weighed 70 pounds. I can now see into her eye sockets. Whatever concentration camp victims there were, outfits, this is what this woman looked like. I could see in her eye sockets. And she's sitting there swabbing her mouth. And I said, "Debbie." Now, she couldn't talk much at all. So I said, I started to talk about what she'd been through, all the things that she'd been through, how hard this was, and how she had written her child the story of her life, and how she had had pictures taken with her child, how she had written her child this letter, how they had done all these things so the child would remember her. And I said, "You've done all these things. You've fought such a fight. You have a great faith in God." I said, "And now I would think you would be so tired, and maybe wanting to just sort of let go." And then the mother has now come in, and I said, "So is there something you haven't done that you need to do that we need to know about so that when you need to go, you can?" And she said, "Something." And I couldn't get it. She's so weak, she can't speak out loud. And I said, write it here. And she said, "They're bringing her." And by now, Mom's reading over my shoulders, and I said, "They're bringing her." And I looked at Mom, and she has eyes of horror on her. And I said, "I think, Debbie, that your parents haven't brought your daughter because this illness hasn't been kind to you. And you don't look like the beautiful Debbie that your daughter is used to seeing. But if you need," and her mother is nodding. And I said, "But if you need to say goodbye to her one more time, we will prepare her so that she can see you." And she sat back, and I could now read her lips, and she said, "No, now I understand." And within 24 hours, she died. But how do you ask someone? I mean, that's how do you ask someone why they can't let go? Why are you dying? I mean, you got to phrase that pretty carefully. And I was petrified, but it was the only way to get the answer. Was the only way to get the answer. And I thank God that I had read the book. Sometimes you can ask very directly, and someone will say, "I need reconciliation with a loved one," or, "I need a priest. I haven't been to confession my whole life. I need absolution, I need confession, I need the sacrament." Some people will be very forthright on what they need. Some people need a heal relationship with a loved one. The most expensive words in the intensive care unit of a hospital
People will wait to die until they hear the words, I love you, I forgive you, thank you. And there's one I'm forgetting. But people will wait. What?
Will you forgive me?
Will you forgive me? Thank you very much. Did you come to this class before? No.
I've been on this journey a lot of times.
Okay, right. People will wait till the people they need to talk to, the prodigal son and daughter, whatever it is, until they have these conversations and can echo these words, as you have heard. Some people need to express gratitude or say goodbye. The saddest things I ever encountered with the AIDS patients whose families wouldn't come in those days that the stigma was so bad, the days before the triple cocktail that would keep our AIDS patients alive and doing well. Sometimes people are way more upfront about what they need. And I'm going to read this. As a chaplain, there are times when the encounters that I have are so amazing, I just have to go back. And I'm not a journaler, but there are times you just have to write something down because you are so touched and you want to be able to remember this encounter. So I'm just going to read what I wrote. I'm sharing this with you because what I'm hoping you're doing in this time is taking what I'm giving you, storing it in there so that when you need it, you will take these stories, that they will be the hook that you need and be able to do what you need to do with your loved ones. I had never met the patient. The ICU nurse says she's only 52 years old. She's dying of heart and lung problems. She's a DNR, do not resuscitate. She wants to talk. Her husband and her son are with her. I entered the room and introduced myself. She looked up between difficult breaths and said, I can't do this anymore. It's just too hard. You've been through a lot, I said, and I took her hand. Yes, and I'm too tired to fight anymore. Her husband and her son nodded to me, affirming her long, hard journey. They talked about her illness and its history. I just want to die, she said. Judy, we will do everything we can to take care of you. Now, you need to ask the question. If this is one of your family members, you need to ask the question. And what do you need in order to die peacefully? She thought for a moment and she said, I need to talk to my four children and my father. I nodded to her husband. Can you arrange that? Yes, he nodded. We need to ask more. What do you need from them? Let's get specific here. I need them to give me their blessing, that my dying is okay with them and that they will let me go. How old is she? 52. How many times do we want to let someone who's 52 die? That they will let me go. I looked at both her husband and her eldest son. They nodded, but with tears in their eyes. Judy, your husband will arrange for your family to come. She seemed to relax, but only a bit. I knew that such and such a church was listed on her chart, so I said, is there a pastor that you would like to call from your church? We don't know him very well. He's new. We went on to discuss how it would be helpful to have him come at a time like this because he would be doing the service. But Judy was still tense. Are you afraid, Judy, of what lies ahead? She nodded and she grabbed my other hand. Would you like me to share with you what may happen as you approach your transition from this world to the next? She nodded. I then shared with her the physical slowdown of her body, how the nurses and doctors would do everything they could to keep her comfortable, and finally how her spirit would lift from her body. I asked her who had died previous to her and who would be there to greet her. And she said, my mother and my son. Yeah. I asked her if I could pray a prayer for a peaceful transition. We made a circle with her husband and her son, and I prayed. I don't use a book. I just take what people tell me in their story and make that into the prayer. So that's what I did, using all the information she had given me. She then laid her head back on the pillow and sighed. She seemed to relax for the first time. I'm tired now, she said, and she closed her eyes. What did she do? She dismissed me. She's done. Yeah. I turned to her husband and said, may I suggest we get a private room up on the floors so you can have your whole family with you as much as possible. No, you have that right in a hospital. If you have a loved one who's in the ICU and they've made a decision they want to die, and we don't need all this machinery and lack of privacy, know that you have the right to say, I'd like to have my loved one go to a private room. I called the pastor and so on. I'm told Judy died peacefully 1.5 days later in a private room surrounded by her family. She was able to communicate very honestly and upfront what she needed before she died. Again, you might be the one that needs to ask your loved one, what do you need? What do you need from us as your family? What can we do for you? The class I taught yesterday was on life review and reminiscing. Some people, when they're farther away from death, well, that's one of the things they need to do. I'm not going to go over any of that. Feel free to look that up online also when you get home. But one of the things I did with patients, and you can do with your family members, is I would say to patients, especially cancer or AIDS patients, would you like to write your last letters to your loved one? And what we would do is, if they were coherent enough and capable enough, they would bring in their computer. They say, that's a good idea. And they say, what do you think I should say? Well, you tell them what you love them, and you affirm them. And if they're children, you affirm what you hope they become as they grow up. But people who were, there's only a certain window that you can do this. If they're sure they're going to get better, and you're saying you want to write last letters to loved one, that doesn't work well. So, but you can't wait so long that they aren't coherent, that they're now taking too much Ativan and morphine, and they can't put two sentences together. I had one patient who forgot to tell me about one of her 5 children. So I had the 4 letters, and she said that at the, and I was reading them off. She said, well, where's Harry? And I said, who's Harry? What if I had gone to the funeral home and given these 4 children their letters, and there sits Harry? So you want to make sure that they're coherent enough, and they would dictate the letters to me. I would read them back. We'd tweak them. I would type them out for them, put them on beautiful stationery, put them in an envelope, and for some of them, I just gave them to them and said, put them in your lockbox, or give this to your spouse, or then I've gone to the funeral home and passed them out. So that's something you can do, too, as you help a loved one to write those last letters. Some people, we talked about this yesterday, Susan mentioned it, some people who are getting ready to die want to give away their belongings. And there's a Jewish saying, I'm giving you this with a warm hand. I want to give you this plate, as Susan said, that she got. And this belonged to my great-grandmother, and this is the story that she brought it over from Norway, and she served, as Susan said, sugar cookies on it. I'm embellishing her story a little bit, but anyway. So some people want to do that. And you can help people absolutely do things like that, and it's a wonderful thing. Sometimes children have said to me, you know, my parents can't handle this. My parents can't handle the fact that I'm going to die. And I wonder how many times I have been present with a situation, and the loved one has been here day and night, day and night, day and night. They finally got home to take a shower, and what happens? The patient, loved one, beloved, dies. They come back and they go, I've been here day and night. I promised myself I would be there. I promised myself I would be there, and I wasn't there. And they're beating themselves up. And I say, I've been a chaplain for a long time. Can I reframe that for you? I want to know if this grandmother that died here was the sort of person who was always the caregiver, who wanted to take care of you, and wanted to make sure that your life wasn't too hard, and did this for you and did that for you. Is that what that person was like 100% of the time? In my case, anyway, they said, yeah, that's just who she was. And I said, I've seen this happen more than once, but many times people will die when there's no one in the room, because they don't want you to remember them taking their last breath. They want you to remember them alive and vital and laughing and smiling, and they don't know how it's going to be at the end, so they just want to slip away. And I get called in the middle of the night. What are the most times I'm called? Between 1 and 3. Why? It's the quietest time of the night. Many times, if loved ones are there, they've fallen off to sleep, or they've gone down to the lounge to catch a little nap. It's the quiet time. It must be when the angels come. I don't know. But when I have reframed this for these people, you can physically see them go, oh, okay, all right, I can accept that. And I say, It's their final gift to you. The quote of this book, Final Gifts. When people are dying, we get gifts from them, and they give us gifts. And sometimes the gift is, I leave where you don't have to see that last breath. Those who are sitting next to the bed, sometimes you are there. You do get to be there. We're going to talk about talking you through that transition in just a minute. And you do get to hold the hand. And as Christy said to me today, that she has had family members die, and how amazing it is to be invited into that space and to be able to walk with people and talk with people through that transition from this world to the next. And we're going to go over that. Excuse me. Also, while I'm seeing this, I have a handout for you, so please don't leave before I give you that. Sometimes people will wait until a specific time. There was a high school senior who was dying of cancer who said, I don't want to spoil it for my friends, which is very coherent. I don't want to spoil it for my friends, so I'm not going to die till after the prom, which is this weekend, and after graduation, which is this weekend. Do you know when she died? The Monday after graduation. When people say you die when your time is up, I don't know where that came from, but I don't believe it. I think we have a lot of control. People will wait till that person who's flying in, and we get a phone call. You know, I'm stranded in Chicago, but I'm renting a car, and I'm going to try and get there as fast as I can. And the person is in ICU, we say, your loved one's getting here. They're getting as soon as I can. Hold on. The person says, I'm holding on. I need to see. I haven't seen my son for 3 years. I want to say goodbye. I had a situation like that, and I did say that now they're on their way. They're at the Moline Airport. They'll be here soon. I said to the rest of the family, when son Jonathan gets here, I want you all to step out, because these people have things to say to each other that they maybe need to say in the privacy of just the dialogue they have. So they all piled out. The person went in. We closed the door. 4.5 minutes later, the son walked out. Yes, I got to talk. I got to talk to him. I got to say what I needed to say. I knew that she heard what I said, and she was able to acknowledge it. I mean, even at the last moment, these times of reconciliation can happen, and people can die in peace. Sometimes they have to wait because there's one person who won't give them permission. One person who won't give them permission, and they'll hang on and hang on and hang on until perhaps that person is able to do that. What I want to say here before I forget is many of you have sat at the bedside or have missed an opportunity because you say, I can't do that. I just can't do that. And some of you at this point may even be beating yourself up to say, I missed an opportunity to do that. And you're mad at yourself. And what I'd say to you is you can't beat yourself up for what you didn't know. And if you didn't know how to do that then, and hopefully you'll leave here with just a few tools that will help you be able to do that with more comfort. And even if you're uncomfortable, stay with it, because you'll, as you sit there, you will perhaps learn to be comfortable, and you'll be glad that you did it. To just give you an example of talking somebody through their transition, this was also an experience that I had that was so profound to me, I again, afterwards, sat down and had to process it by writing it. I had to process it by talking to my boss and mentor. And I've wanted to teach it because I think it helps us learn how to do this. So I'm just going to read it to you also, not because this is the way to do it, but to give you a story, because I think, again, stories are good ways to hook us into how things can unfold. Janet was the nurse, and she asked me to stop and see Carol. She said, she isn't responding. She may have had a stroke. She's in a coma or semi-comatose state. Her husband and her parents are here. Carol is 47 years old. She has advanced cancer, and she's a do not resuscitate. I'd never met her before. I walked in the door, and her mom was standing next to her bed, stroking her forehead and her face. Tell me about Carol, I said. Her mom told me stories about Carol and her illness as she stroked her face. Her father came in and next her husband. And then Carol became terribly agitated. She was not able to respond to us, and she was in some sort of state. And all of a sudden, Carol became extremely agitated, and her head is going back and forth and back and forth, and these guttural sounds are coming from her throat. It sounds like she's trying to talk, but we didn't know what was going on. Carol became agitated, moving her arms and making this constant guttural sound that seems to indicate she was talking. The nurse tried to give her some additional meds to calm her. It wasn't seeming to be effective. Her guttural sounds in her distress continued and escalated. Her husband took her hand, but as this distress increased, her coloring was changing, her eyes were wide, her head was going back and forth, and he now couldn't handle it, and he walked away. Now the mother is panicking, and the nurse is indicating to me things are not going well, and this may be it. I asked her mom if she would like me to talk to Carol and might be able to walk her through what's happening to her. She absolutely said yes, and we traded places, so now I'm by her head and she's holding her hand. Carol, I know this is hard for you, very hard, I said as I took her hand. You are having trouble breathing and feeling scared, but your nurse is here and she's going to give you some medication that will make you feel less stressful. You may feel sleepy. We will take care of you. We are here for you. I began to see her color change and looked at the nurse, who acknowledged this, in fact, was it. I shared that with her mom. I asked her if I should keep talking to Carol or if she wanted to. She said no, she didn't want to. Carol, pretty soon your breathing will get slower and slower, and you may feel yourself drifting away from us. Your blood pressure may drop, and finally you'll take one breath in this world, and you'll take a breath in the next. You'll have made the transition. Her husband came in, saw what was happening, turned around and left. He just couldn't handle it. You'll feel this earthly body. You'll be leaving this earthly body, and you'll leave the pain behind. You'll leave this labored breathing. You'll move with freedom. Now the head movements have been going back and forth, slowed down, and her breathing slowed down. As a Catholic, and her mother told me this, as a Catholic, and I looked at her mother to confirm this, you have a better of understanding of angels. So you may understand. You may know that your guardian angel, who's been with you your whole life, may be here to escort you to your new heavenly home. She has now stopped moving her head. It's in the middle of her pillow, and she opens her eyes. You may see a bright light, and you'll be drawn to it because you are being drawn to the love of God. She now turns her head, and she's looking directly at me. She's been in a coma for some time. I know you don't want to leave this family behind, but your new family, those who have died before you in Christ, will be there to welcome you, and you'll be home, your heavenly home. Her eyes are absolutely locked in mine now. So Carol, I'm going to touch your forehead and remind you of your baptism. You were signed and sealed by the cross of Christ with your baptism. You were declared his, and I put the sign on her forehead. You can rest in the peace that you are God's child. Don't be afraid. It will be easier than you think. She's still looking at me. Her eyes are open, and she seems to understand everything I'm saying. I hesitate to call it death, Carol. I'm now stroking her face. You don't end. You simply move from this world to a better one. I looked at the nurse who was now taking her blood pressure, and I've worked with these nurses before, so we can kind of communicate with their eyes that, yes, in fact, we were going to be losing her. I kept talking to her. Her mother kept holding her hand. I kept assuring her of God's love and grace, that she could go in peace, that her family were here and loved her. All of a sudden, her eyes glazed over. Her eye contact was gone, and her head fell to one side. I turned around to her mother, and tears are streaming down my face. Tears are streaming down her face. We embraced, and her mother said, I've never seen anything like that. And I said, neither have I. I went and talked to the husband, talked to the father. I knew they were Catholics, so I was going to get a priest for them. And I walked out to the nurse's station, and the head nurse, who used to be Catholic and now isn't Christian but has some sort of religious, I'm not sure, maybe she's a humanist. She looked at me and she said, I hear you're a midwife. And I looked at her and I had no idea what she was talking to. She said, I hear you midwifed Carol into the next world. It took my breath away. And then it gave word and gave term to what we get to do if we have the privilege of sitting with someone when they're dying. We get to be present to that. As we women give birth, we want our beloveds there helping us give birth to this child. And when someone is dying, we as people of faith, how much better that we're there than a chaplain that you might call who doesn't know the person, or even your minister. It's wonderful to have your minister, but you know this beloved. You know the terms that they use to describe their own faith. You know the things. You know the loved ones that are going to be there to greet them on the other side. And so when I had called the pastor and the priest, and I went down to my boss's room, and I walked in the door, and I slammed the door, and I said, it shouldn't have been me who was there. And he goes, Jeannie, you better just sit down and tell me the whole story. So I sat down, and my boss, who is wise beyond wise, sat there and listened to me tell this story. And I said, it shouldn't have been me. Carol had never heard my voice before. She didn't know me. I wasn't her family members. I wasn't her priest. And he said, was there anyone else in the family who was going to do that for her? Did you ask permission of her mother? Did she want to do it? No. Could her husband stay in the room? No. Could her father stay in the room? No. Was her priest there? No. He said, you had to be the one. And I said, then I am going to take this book, and I'm going to put it into a class, and anywhere they call me to teach this class, I'm going to do it, so that people will be equipped to be able to do that to your own loved ones. Questions, responses, stories. I need a drink of water.
Oh, I just have a quick story. I was up here in 93, and Jeannie was up here too, and my mom had just passed away about a year before then, and she was one of those people that died when nobody else was there, and I was having a really hard time with that, but I came here, and then she's the one that told me about the Final Gifts book. And that was the thing that really started turning me around. You know? And I think the other thing that I was kind of lucky, because my mom was a very strong Christian, and before she went in the coma, she was seeing people that we weren't seeing. And she says, God is granting me a full life, and I'm ready to go. So when your mother says that, you have to kind of let go. So anyway, it was really nice to see Jeannie again.
I knew I recognized. I thought, how do I know her? You know, and then she told me, oh, of course. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. I've noticed that that there was a lot more stories about women that you've had this experience with, and not as many men. And I'm just curious,
interesting.
Yeah, because I think you said she about every story, and I just started realizing that, and I didn't know if that would maybe be because women. You know, if I'm going to typecast people, are sometimes more able to let go of their emotions and share that, and I don't know. I mean, do you find that you have that experience with men?
No one's ever asked that question. I've never thought of that question. It's a great one. I have no idea. I mean, I can see what you're saying, that women are perhaps more that way. In the book, there are plenty of stories of men. I mean, you know, the AIDS patient and the... but I'm going to think about that. I don't know. I would say we are more emotional and we're more verbal about some of these things. But the book also has plenty of men's stories. So, but thank you. I don't know.
My father passed away, and he did wait till we all got there. But there wasn't any, and he was a pastor. I wasn't there when he died. But the rest of my family was, my grandfather was. And I think that was really important at the time, because he was a doctor and he brought him into the world.
Wow.
And he said, when he was born, I held him up by the foot. And he said, and now here he is dying, and I'm holding on to his foot.
There's beauty in that full circle, isn't there? There's beauty in that full circle.
And I think it was more important for my grandparents to be there than anyone else. Yes. But then my grandmother also recently passed away, and she had the same experience that you described several times about seeing the Holy Spirit. And we all believed her, you know. We didn't think it was weird at all for her. But that emotional, I guess, is what I'm talking about, that they feel that maybe women feel that they can share that, and men maybe don't.
I believe in starting in time and ending on time. We'll take this as the last one, and then I'll let anyone go who needs to get to chapel. Could you put that by the back door, pass them
up? I just wanted to thank you for saying this about between 2 and 3 in the morning. So I had my husband home when he passed away. I was able to care for him until he passed. But I had gone to bed. His brother sat beside him that night. I don't know if he's asleep or not. But Malcolm's breathing was slowing down, mm-hmm. and I had said my goodbyes, and I went to rest. And he always was so considerate of me, so that was his gift. Mm-hmm. He died when I was
hospitalized. It was his gift, final gift. They come in a variety of ways. Thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it.